As Christmas is approaching, which I'm sure you've all probably noticed, I wanted to sort of start to approach the Christmas story today. I know we've got a few weeks, I know we're going to be building up to it, but I just wanted to start approaching it by looking at Micah chapter 5. So it's kind of the beginning of the Christmas story, hundreds of years before Jesus came. Because when the wise men traveled from the east in Matthew's gospel, seeking the king, they knew that a king had been born, and they came to pay tribute. They went to Jerusalem and they consulted Herod, because he was the king at the time. And they wanted to know where this new king was, and Herod was completely foxed. He had no idea. And, you know, and he was a little bit miffed about it, to say the least, because he was the king. So he went to the chief priests, and he said, "What's this about a new king? Who is this new king? And where will he be born? I need answers." And amazingly, they had an answer for him. They already knew. They knew that a king was coming. Not this worldly king, not somebody to replace King Herod in his exact role. But they knew that somebody was coming, and it would be a very special king. It would be their Messiah. They knew the Messiah was coming, they just didn't know when, but they did know where. They knew that he'd be born in a tiny village of Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is obviously the name of a place that we're all very familiar with, but it was an insignificant spot on the map. They knew this because his birthplace and his ministry had been foretold in this book, Micah. In chapter 5, I'll be reading from verse 2 up to just a small part of verse 5. "But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel. And he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace." Like a lot of the Old Testament prophet writings, Micah is a mixture of warnings and promises. It's a mixture of judgment and hope. And in chapter 4, God had warned the people of Israel that they were going to be defeated by Babylon and taken into captivity. And this was judgment for their constant sin, their constant idolatry, their constant failure to follow God's commands, their constant rebellion. But immediately after that, he says, Babylon's coming. They're coming to get you. But then we have this wonderful and strange set of promises in verses 2 to 4 that someone is coming in the name of the Lord. Now, Micah was written about 700 years before Christ was born. 700 years before Christ was born. But he, even back then, he predicted that out of Bethlehem would rise this Messiah figure, this Messiah, this anointed one, as Sonia mentioned, anointed. To be anointed was to, you know, literally to have oil poured on you. But it was part of a well-known and well-established ceremony and a ritual where if a king or a priest or a prophet had been identified and chosen for a specific role, a ritual to recognize them and to sort of point out to everybody around that this person had been chosen in a special way was to pour oil on them. So it's someone who would be chosen as a prophet or a priest or a king. But of course, Jesus was all of these. Prophet, priest, and king. But Bethlehem of all places, right? Because, as I said, we all know the name Bethlehem. But it was nothing back then. It was a tiny, ragged little settlement of hardly any consequence whatsoever. Now, it was where King David was born. It was where King David originated. But it was so small that in Joshua chapter 15, when Joshua was naming all of the towns and the cities and the places of the land that they were moving into to be divided up, where the promised land was to be divided up amongst the different tribes, he named 115 different places. And Bethlehem wasn't even important enough to make the list. It existed then, but it wasn't worth mentioning. And you know, I think just that little detail speaks volumes, okay? Because it's just like God to take something small and weak and insignificant, something that nobody else would have taken any notice of, and to use it as a crucial part of his great plan. Just something that in the world's eyes is nothing, would have been ignored by everybody. But God chose it as the birthplace, first of all, as the mighty King David, the first real king who stood in God's name, the shepherd boy who God raised up to lead Israel. First of all, King David came from there. And afterwards, he promised that it would be the site of one of the most breathtaking events, probably the most breathtaking event in history, the birthplace of the Son of God. So, an insignificant thing that God made significant. Because God doesn't need to fit himself into the plans and the standards and the ways of the world. God doesn't need to do everything the way that we would do it. Quite often does things the way that we wouldn't. And with the people of Israel facing the oncoming hordes of the Assyrian army, hoping beyond hope that a warrior would be raised up to lead them, to defend them, to give them hope, God said, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm not going to do it your way. They would have turned to the rulers of the cities. They would have turned to the kings and the warlords and the generals and the leaders of armies and the lords and the wealthy and the powerful. And God said, that's not what I'm going to do. In one of his many messages of hope, God promised he would send them a shepherd. Not a warlord, not a warrior, not a king in a worldly sense, but a shepherd from a tiny speck of a town. Micah says that Bethlehem's about to produce one who is from of old, from ancient days. New King James, it says, from everlasting. The Hebrew for it apparently could also be translated as from the days of eternity. One who is from the days of eternity. This means that the king coming from Bethlehem had no starting point. So that didn't make sense to them. He didn't have a beginning, but he was going to come from Bethlehem. It's not like King David or any other king the world has seen. He's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who's the descendant of the house of David. He'll be born, and yet at the same time, will be from eternity. He'll walk the earth like a man, but he always existed. This is why John's Gospel opens with those amazing words, in the beginning was the Word. Not in the beginning the Word started. In the beginning of everything that we know and everything we understand and everything we everything we will ever come to understand. Got it out in the end. In the beginning, he was already there. Jesus Christ was already there, and God would send somebody who has always been. This is the Father saying, I will send my eternal Son, although at the time they couldn't have possibly understood that. All Micah knew and all Israel knew afterwards was that God was sending someone unlike anybody who had ever walked the earth before, and he would be a ruler for God and one who represented God to the world and who would come in the strength and the majesty of the Lord. Now, in the ancient world, a ruler, a king or any other person in power would generally have gotten there by conquest, by military power. But this Jesus wouldn't be somebody who was constantly looking over his shoulder, constantly looking to defend his borders, constantly looking to maintain an army, constantly looking to hold on to his position, constantly worried that somebody might come along and snatch it from him. He didn't get to his position by conquering someone or building a worldly empire. He didn't need to. Because there's nothing that can overthrow him, and there's nothing that can stand against him, and there's no barrier that's too difficult for him. Nothing can overthrow him. Think of that. Nothing can stand in his way. He was the Lord at the beginning, and he'll be the Lord at the end. He'll be the Lord when he returns and washes away this broken world and makes all things new. A ruler in the ancient world would have had very little time for the people of their kingdom, because they came there by conquest, they sought power for their own sake, and generally speaking, would have only wanted to maintain that power by crushing people if necessary. Looking after people wasn't a priority. Taking care of people wasn't a priority. And there was no law that said they had to. You know, we have laws and infrastructure and things now in place that says that people have to be looked after. People have to be cared for. People can't be mistreated. But here comes this ruler who's not a warlord or a king or a warrior, and he's not even described as a victor. In contrast to the rulers who didn't care about anyone as long as they paid their taxes, along comes a shepherd. They wanted a warrior, and they received a shepherd. A shepherd wasn't a position that was thought very highly of in the ancient world, we could say. And despite that, some of the most important prophets sent by God began as shepherds or lived a life as a shepherd. Moses, after he fled into the wilderness, tended the flocks of his father-in-law before God called him back out of the wilderness. God sent the prophet Samuel in search of his future king, and he found David in the field tending his flocks. A shepherd is someone who carefully and tirelessly tends to a flock, protecting them and guiding them and leading them and providing for them, keeping them from harm, and overseeing them in a way they aren't capable of doing themselves. And of course, the most beloved and well-known psalm, and perhaps the best-known portion of the Bible, compares God to our shepherd who watches over us. He's described as a shepherd all over the Bible. Some examples could be found in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 10 and 11. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and he rules with a mighty arm. See, his reward is with him and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. In Psalm 95, verse 7, it says, for he is our God and we are the people he shepherds, the sheep in his hands. And you can, you know, if you just go to a concordance and you look up shepherd, you'll find probably dozens of verses where God's compared to a shepherd, and as to his sheep or his flock. This Messiah will shepherd his flock. His flock. He's eternal, and he's ruler, and he's one who watches over and cares for his people. And whether people acknowledge it or not, whether people like it or not, this ruler is sent in the majesty of the name of the Lord, his God. And he's coming armed with the authority of God. And he's ruler of everything. And he hasn't come to watch over everyone. He hasn't come to watch over everyone. And there are those that would have you believe that salvation is for everyone. And forgiveness is for everyone. But the Bible very clearly teaches that it is not for everyone. A shepherd will care for his own flock, but he'll not spend his time and resources looking after someone else's. But for those who do belong to him, for those who are in his flock, they are his precious possession. They are his beloved. They are his lambs. They were bought with his blood. They are the ones that he has promised will spend eternity with him. And when the Bible describes Jesus as our shepherd, makes very one thing very clear. We are needy. We need help. We need hope. We need salvation. We need a shepherd who will be our saviour. And it's very tempting to deny that we need such help. You know, our society, I think, Western society in particular, and our world and our culture condition us to believe that we should do everything for ourselves, and we should be strong. And we should be independent, and we should be self-sufficient. And you know, it's part of what you could call the Disney dream. The Disney dream, you know. And it's been fed to our children. And it's been fed to everybody. Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. Chase your dreams. Follow your heart, and you can achieve, and you can do this, and you can do that, and da 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 da. And do you know what? It's like so many lies. It's got a nugget of truth, okay? Because we can't deny people who are confident and who trust their abilities and work hard will achieve things. Of course they will. They will achieve a lot more than people who don't have confidence in themselves, and they'll achieve a lot more than people who don't work hard. But you know what? There's a limit to how far they'll go. What our culture tells you is you can do anything if you believe, and you can do anything if you work hard, and you can do anything if you trust in yourself, and you can do anything if you're confident, and you can't. You can do a lot of things in this world, is what you can do. You can do a great deal of stuff in this world. And even that has a limit, obviously. But there's only so much that can be achieved this way. And the shepherd understands that there's a limit to what his sheep can do. And the sheep need to understand that the shepherd can provide things that they cannot provide themselves. And Jesus did not come for those who think they can do everything for themselves. And Jesus did not come for those who believe that they are capable of achieving everything and capable of providing themselves with everything that they need. There's a very popular saying, God helps those who help themselves. And do you know what? That doesn't add up. God doesn't help those who help themselves. God helps those who know they can't help themselves. God gives strength to those who will go to him and say, I can't do this, but I know you can. God helps those who knows they are helpless. Because it's only by being helpless we can understand that we have to throw ourselves on his mercy and ask for his help. But God's promise there in verse 4 is they will live securely and he will be their peace. Be their peace. Remember that Michael's writing this to a country that was facing an invading army. That was facing God's judgment in the form of an invading army. And he wasn't promising worldly peace. Wasn't what he was promising. He wasn't promising that he was going to snap his fingers and make all their troubles go away. Of course he can, and sometimes he will. But he wasn't promising that. He was promising something much more significant. This ruler, this ancient and eternal one, would bring peace between us and God. Between us and God. This word peace, the Hebrew word shalom, which you may have heard, which you may know. It's got a whole range of meanings. It's a whole bunch of words. Because, Hebrew apparently had a very small vocabulary. They didn't have a lot of words, and they'd make one word do a lot of work. They'd really get their money's worth out of each and every syllable. And this word shalom, it means peace, but it means wholeness and tranquility and harmony and this sense, this all of these things that flow out of inner peace. It's not just the peace that can be found when everything's going well for you. It's easy to find that peace. It's much more, it's the peace that enables us to trust in God and rest in him. And that's not always easy, and I know it's not. Because we know the world is broken. And we know that there are often storms that are far out of our control. And we know that we're often faced with things and we desperately want God to take them away. Sometimes he will and sometimes he won't. But we are promised, which is difficult to wrap our heads around sometimes, we're promised that he works all things together for good. And sometimes that good is the eternal good. And that our eternity is in his hands. Jesus told the Pharisees in John chapter 10, he said, I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. Every child of God belongs to that flock today. Every one of us has been blessed by the good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep. For all of us who know that we're helpless without him. But, you know, I want to thank God today that he sent a shepherd who will guide us and hold us and provide for our eternal needs. And I wanted to speak on this because with Christmas coming, and with this realization that God planned it hundreds of years in advance, thousands of years in advance, all the way back in Genesis, you know, he was already promising that this was coming. And this is a reminder that whatever else is going on, we know God has his plan. Whatever else is going on, we know that God is in control. Whatever else is going on, we know that God is there for us. And it's not always easy. But I think it's good to remember that when it comes to eternity, we're on the victory side. And we're all in his hands. Amen.